Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the first episode of the Calcioland Podcast of the Week. It's that time of year where we try to do three a week. There's a lot of transfer news to get to. Today we are going to focus on that. We had an interview scheduled, but unfortunately the guest had an important personal emergency to attend to, so we'll try to bring in some guests later on in the week. But if you're looking for a fix on transfers, you're in the right place. So before we get to the specific updates on players and various teams, I'm joined by our great friend, Alex Goldberg, our producer, co-host, the leader of the Conte Out faction on Twitter, just doing a fantastic job with the podcast and with tweets. So, Alex, one of our listeners asked me, you know, what can the Italian press do to improve the quality of the transfer news? But because, you know, I really go out of my way not to pass judgment on the work of others, I wanted to phrase this question in a different way to you, Alex. Do you feel, because nowadays between Twitter accounts, Reddit, podcasts, various news sites and whatnot, do you feel like the transfer news you're getting is more accurate because you're getting so much of it? Or do you think that there's just too much and maybe some of it is just noise? What's your take on that? Do you think more necessarily makes you more informed?
Honestly, David, I think more, on average, makes you less informed. And I can speak from experience. I remember when I first got on Twitter and I got really into football and transfers, I would follow every transfer site possible because I was so thirsty to hear what players could even just 5% chance come to Chelsea or whatever team I was rooting for, primarily Chelsea. But I didn't care about the quality. I wanted the quantity. It was almost a fun game for me each day getting to fantasize about this player on Chelsea, even if I knew there was only like a 5% chance. Then after a while, it just became too much, and I wanted to whittle it down, simplify, get more quality, less quantity. Of course, that's when I found DiMarzio and all of you, and then I became way more informed about transfers. I think in this scenario, if you have to be, or if you want to be on Twitter and Reddit a lot, you have to simplify things. You have to put quality above quantity, or else you'll just get so tired and frustrated, because if you follow just anybody on Twitter that has anything to do with transfers, you're going to have such a roller coaster of emotions, and it's not going to be good for your health. And so if anybody relies still on a newspaper to give them transfers or something where it's less active, maybe it's just a daily thing, they're probably more informed as long as they're getting it from a somewhat credible newspaper. I assume if that's still what they're doing to this point using newspapers, they know what's credible and what's not. So, David, to answer the original question, yes, I do think more access on average makes you less informed. That's my opinion. What about you?
Yeah, and I have a lot of thoughts on this topic. And, you know, it's interesting you talked about newspapers. And, you know, I always like to remind people I'm old. I've always had a passion for transfer news. I remember at a young age, I used to, like, write out what every team in Serie A should do before the summer started. I've always had a passion for it. And I remember, you know, when I was growing up was well before the internet. I grew up in Italy, was following a lot of Serie A teams, but I'd spend a lot of my summers with my grandparents, which was in the south of France or New York. I was very lucky with my upbringing, and I remember, you know, my biggest source of news back then, there was no internet, was trying to get a 2-3-day-old Gazzetta dello Sport and try to follow what was going on there. And I have to be honest, sometimes when I look at the amount of all the information that's on Twitter, I almost feel like I was more informed back then with that newspaper 2-3 days old. And look, you know, anyone can tweet what they think is appropriate. It's not for me to pass judgment on what anyone wants to tweet. But I think, you know, if you get a lot of news, and this isn't just transfers, but let's narrow it down to transfer from Twitter, there's a lot of things that are problematic. For one, the more you get news from a Twitter account as opposed to the original source, the more the odds that you're a victim of the telephone game. And what I mean by that is a newspaper or a website or a credible source report something. A Twitter account takes a nugget of that information and writes the tweet out. Sometimes you're reading the tweet from someone that follows a team specifically, so they highlight more the part of the news on their team. Then someone else picks up on that and changes it again. So, you know, we live in an era of a lot of newspapers and websites like quoting each other. I remember a few weeks ago, there was a lot of people asking me that La Stampa, which is the newspaper based in Turin, who's owned by the same parent company as Juve, was reporting that there was an imminent deal with Manchester United. So I tried to go on to La Stampa and see exactly what was going on. La Stampa is behind the paywall, so you need to have a subscription, which I don't, to see what happened. And then it turns out that report was La Stampa just saying people in England, newspapers in England, are saying this. So it became that La Stampa, because people on Twitter took that nugget, was confirming the news from someone else, when in the end they were just reporting that. Things like that unfortunately happen time and time again. Not to get into the aspect of mistranslation, Google Translate, and whatnot. So I think there's a lot of issues with this. I always encourage people to try it as much as possible to get it specifically from the source. On Di Marzio's site, I only hire people that are very fluent in Italian that can actually really understand what is written in the Italian site and translate it to English as accurately as possible. Now, sometimes even the reports on the Italian site aren't very clear, and we do our best. But I think that's much better than going off with someone Google translated. Not to mention how often people, in a desire to get retweets and follows and whatnot, just flat out make stuff up and attribute it to Di Marzio. Now we also have another layer of this, people taking information from podcasts. Alex, you're starting to be quoted in some tabloids, and nothing wrong with that, but again, they're taking things pretty out of context. The day doesn't go by that I don't get a notification that I'm cited on a newspaper and different on a website in different parts of the world. Sometimes it's accurate, sometimes not so much. So I think it's really important. It's up to the consumer in the end to decide and, you know, try to weed out the noise and try to go to these sources that you think are credible. One of the last things I'll say too is that I think, you know, it's also important. There are people who tweet a lot of news, even when they know that the source maybe isn't the best, or even that it's they know deep down that it's bullshit and they're just tweeting it anyway. If someone says, you know, what is this stuff? They'll say, hey, don't blame me. I'm just reporting what this person is saying. Well, you know, the reason those websites keep reporting garbage is because people keep tweeting about it. So I think it's up to the consumer to try to be a bit more disconcerting, and slowly but surely, maybe it can be evolution if only the places that are accurate tweet the news and you're only quoting accurate places, we'll all be better off for it. And I think, you know, we can weed out the noise. The last comment I have on this, and as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. I think it's really important when people try to decide if a transfer news is accurate or not. I think it's so important to look at the deal from all three aspects, not just from the team you support. So if you're, you know, let's say hypothetically, you're a Manchester United fan or you're a fan of Chelsea, you're like, oh yeah, we could really use Milinkovic-Savic, or let's use a better example, we could use Dybala. Like, you also have to look, take into account, what does the player want to do? What does the selling club want to do? So I think that's how I always look to answer transfers. If someone asks me an opinion on something that we're not reporting on, the first thing I do is ask myself, why are the reasons this deal won't happen? And I try to look at it that way, as opposed to the other way around and just looking, oh, this team needs this player. That makes sense. Well, let's look at it a little bit deeper. So that's my 2 cents on all that. It's definitely an important topic. And one of the things we try to do on this podcast is to try to give you the most accurate information possible and try to entertain you along the way. So before we get to your Twitter questions, I just wanted to give an update on Torreira. We're recording this at 1 p.m. Boston time, so 7 p.m. in Italy. Di Marzio posted a new update. So as far as the transfer fee between Sampdoria and Arsenal, I think that's the easy part of this. The exit clause is relative low amount, 25 million euro. Now, that would be payable in one installment Arsenal and Sampdoria are fine with making that transfer fee $30 million, but then having Arsenal pay it over multiple years, which obviously would make it a easier pill to swallow. But the tougher part is reaching an agreement with the player. A lot of people are pointing out, you know, why is his exit clause so low? Well, that was part of the negotiation. Smart for an agent to try to get the lowest exit clause possible, because then they can ask for better terms for the player and themselves on the commission. So probably the transfer fee was negotiated for below market value transfer fee, but it doesn't surprise me that they're trying to take advantage of that and ask for a bigger fee. So let's see if they can agree to terms on this. I think Arsenal has a pretty good chance of getting this deal done. And with that out of the way, let's get to the questions submitted by our listeners. We're going to try to do three podcasts a week. We want to give you the content that you want to hear. So if you want to send us a question, please use the CultureLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's kick off with Roma. Is the fact that Roma are spending so much money a telltale sign that they already sold Alisson?
So this kind of goes back to tribalism and the way transfer news is reported and discussed on Twitter. I saw some Liverpool fans. There's a lot of buzz on seeing Roma spending all this money. Does that mean that Alisson has already been sold? And I think that's really a kind of missing the point. So for one, compared to years past where Roma had to sell a big name by June 30th to meet their financial fair play deadline, this year they'll probably be able to get away with that with just a minor sale. So someone like Juan Jesus, Bruno Perez, something along those lines. So their financial situation's already better, and that's because of all the revenue they got from the Champions League, which is the obvious one, but the very underrated reason as to why they're in much better shape is because of that deal Roma did with Chelsea in January for Emerson Palmieri for a significant fee, which was almost entirely a profit for Roma because they hadn't spent a lot on Palmieri to begin with. So Roma's in much better financial shape to begin with. And the fact that people are saying they're spending a ton of money, yeah, they have made some pretty big moves, but Cristante is coming on loan with a forced option to buy, so the payment is spread out. As I'm reading now, Kluivert is going to come to the city today, so he'll be fairly expensive, but Coric was only $6 to $7 million. The defender they got from Porto was on a free transfer. So I don't even know if we can say, when you consider the Cristante fee is being on a loan with option to buy, that Roma has spent a ton. So I don't see a connection between the fact that Roma already knows Alisson and Gunn and their spending. Now, it's certainly possible that Alisson could be sold. I actually think this summer there's a pretty good chance that's going to happen. But I think connecting it to Roma with all their spending is just inaccurate and just not the case. And it just goes back to the tribalism in football and people just looking at one side of the equation on a transfer.
All right, staying on Roma, David, could Florenzi end up at Chelsea? And with rumors of Bruno Perez also leaving, who will be Roma's right back next season?
So Roma has been negotiating with Florenzi on an extension for quite some time. I think his deal expires next year. Now, Florenzi is trying to get paid like some of their top players, you know, more in the $4 million a year. And again, I want to stress, a transfer, like wages in Italy are reported after taxes, in the UK before. So when you hear Florenzi $4 million a year, that's net of taxes. In UK wages, that would be $8 million a year. So let's see if he can pull that off. I think that's a pretty significant amount of money to be paid. At the same time, his camp is pointing out that Perotti makes around $3 million a year, and Florenzi is a more key player for Roma. So it wouldn't surprise me if they kind of maybe agree in the middle, somewhere in the $3.5 million range. My guess is Florenzi isn't going to leave Roma. For one, you know, the club really likes to have someone from Rome who grew up as a Roma fan as the captain. Totti and De Rossi are in that camp. Florenzi would be next in line for that. It doesn't surprise me that he's linked to Chelsea. They could definitely use an upgrade at the wing back position, but it also wouldn't surprise me if Florenzi's camp is thrilled that this news is out there to leverage better terms with Roma. As far as the right back position, I think Florenzi is staying put. Bruno Perez is probably going back to Torino, and Roma still has Karsdorp, highly rated, who came last summer, but granted, he's coming off two knee surgeries. But my guess is Florenzi is going to end up staying put.
All right, next question, David. What will Simone Verdi bring to Napoli, and how close is Jorginho to joining Manchester City?
So let's start with the second one. So over the weekend, Napoli president De Laurentiis made a statement that while the deal isn't done, he wouldn't be surprised if the deal with Manchester City is reached in the coming days. Previously, Jorginho's agent had made a lot of noise on how, you know, this was a great opportunity for his client, and they would have really liked for Napoli to, you know, make the deal happen. Now, anyone who's followed Napoli know what tough negotiators they are. They are asking for a lot for Jorginho. I would imagine the deal is going to be completed for around $50 million, probably with some bonuses. Big return for Napoli, but Jorginho was really a key player for them. We know how much Guardiola loves Sarri ball, and Jorginho, there are few players more associated with that style of play. I think with how dynamic Jorginho is, a lot of people know him as a great passer, but also with great pace and how much he runs and sets himself up in passing lanes, I think he's going to fit in perfectly at Manchester City. So my guess is that deal is going to happen, but it's going to be expensive, and good for Napoli for holding up for a big return. I wish more Serie A clubs did it. As far as Verdi, you know, this is an interesting situation because Verdi came close to joining Napoli during the January window. There are a lot of reports that he didn't want to do it because he was afraid Sarri was going to bury him on the bench. But the way I see it, if Verdi is coming to Napoli to be a backup, someone that can be the first forward off the bench, he can play basically any position up front, on the right, left, and in the middle. He's very versatile. That's great. But if he's coming to replace Callejon, those are some big shoes to fill. Like, Callejon has an exit clause, was really a Sarri type of guy. I'm not sure Ancelotti values him as much. But I'd be surprised if Verdi can match Callejon's production at Napoli the past few years. So definitely a good move, but it would have been an even better move if Verdi was definitely coming as a backup. As a starter, again, a lot of pressure just to hold serve and do what Callejon was doing.
All right, David, next one. It's our favorite guy. What's the latest on Alessandro's renewal with Juventus?
So I got asked this a lot because, you know, we've talked a lot on the podcast and it's been tweeted in a lot of places that after Asamoah went to Inter and Spinazzola's injury, Juve is interested in giving Alessandro an extension. So just because you don't read reports of an ongoing negotiation, I wouldn't take that as to mean that it's not going to happen. Like, there's no huge urgency. Alessandro's contract right now runs through 2020, so it's not even that expires next year. He's on a relatively low salary. Like, look, Juve could just keep him, but it makes sense to bring, especially now if they want to make him a more valuable part of the team, to give him a bump. But it also wouldn't surprise me if Juve would be very open to accepting a €50 million bid for Alessandro. I think that's the price where they'd be more than happy to open a negotiation with another club. Alessandro's 27. They bought him for $26 million 3 years ago, so that's a massive profit when you think of how much of that transfer fee has been amortized. Also, the Alessandro from last season wasn't nearly as good as the one from the season before, so I think Juve, for a huge offer, would be willing to play ball, but at the same time, it'd be interesting to see if a club is willing to spend that much on him. His performances were so bad that he didn't make the World Cup team. Granted, I know Brazil stacked at his position, but there's definitely been a drop off. So let's see what happens. I think we'll have more movement on Alessandro after Juve's season ticket campaign. And that usually seems to be the time where there's a lot more news, especially on the outgoing side for Juve.
All right, David, next one. Should Juve continue their efforts to rejuvenate the squad after bringing in Perin to help replace Buffon?
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And beyond, you know, the goalkeeper position, you know, we've also seen it with Caldara coming in. You know, he'll probably get a lot of the playing time that Barzagli had last season. Let's see if Benatia stays as well. Like, I think slowly but surely they want Caldara. Maybe next season's the one where he starts establishing himself as the future starter. Of course, we have Spinazzola, who has the injury. Last summer, we saw Juve try to rejuvenate on the team a little bit on the wing side of things when they brought in Bernardeschi and De Sciglio, so younger players. I think it definitely makes sense for Juve to do this. Emre Can, that deal should be announced soon, so that's more in line with that. So it makes perfect sense for Juve to try to bring down the age of the team.
All right, next Twitter question. David, why haven't PSG announced the Buffon signing?
So there's a couple of things. So for one, for financial fair play, I think PSG, they don't want to add new players to the books until they've started making some sales to start meeting their parameters. As far as I've been told, they need to raise around 70 to 80 million in profits on players that they have to meet those requirements. So maybe it makes more sense to start doing that before announcing a new signing. Also, to me, it makes sense that they would wait for some time to pass in the news cycle from the announcement of a Buffon suspension for his actions in the match against Real Madrid. So, you know, say you sign him and then right after there's the ruling from UEFA on him missing three matches, then you have to answer questions on that. I think the more distance there is between that and the official announcement, the less emphasis there is on the press conference. So that deal is going to happen. I think now it's just a matter of when it's announced.
Okay, fair enough. Next one, how close are Inter to completing a deal for Raja the Ninja Nainggolan, and do they have a realistic shot at Chiesa?
So I have to be honest, I was kind of wrong about this. I dismissed right off the bat Inter having any chance at Nainggolan. Like, in my mind, I was like, okay, Nainggolan could have left in the past to go to Premier League, earn more money. He said how much he loves living in Rome and how what loyalty he has to the club. And I was like, geez, you know, would he really go to another Serie A team instead of going abroad? But I underestimated how much of a bond he has with Inter manager Spalletti. I think that's where his best season were with him. I actually think, you know, if Roma can get close to 40 million from Nainggolan at his age, and I think he's 29, but he's an old 29 because of his lifestyle, I'd be like, God bless him. If that offer comes in, I would do it in a heartbeat. But I don't underestimate how much Spalletti can get out of Nainggolan. To me, it's not out of the question that if he goes to Inter, he could really punish Roma. So I don't think a deal is imminent quite yet, especially because Inter is kind of like in the boat of PSG. They need to raise funds first. Not surprising that we're seeing them selling a lot of their younger players that they can turn a pure profit on to start meeting their financial fair play guidelines. But I'm not going to rule it out altogether that Nainggolan could go to Inter. As far as Chiesa goes, I think he's almost too expensive for any Serie A club, Juve included. I think Fiorentina rightfully is going to hold out for a ton of money for him. I think he's clearly the best young Italian player. Fiorentina, too, they gave him an extension last year. They could keep him another year and see what happens. So as it stands now, I think, unfortunately, it's not just Inter. I think Chiesa's priced out for any Serie A team.
All right, next one. Considering all the uncertainty with financial fair play, their owners, and their limited squad, wouldn't Milan be better off not playing in the Europa League next season?
For me, it's very simple. I actually think for Milan to get really better and be in the place where they need to be, unfortunately, things are going to have to get worse before they get better. I think they need to solve the ownership situation. Kind of like Nainggolan, at first I totally dismissed the idea of a minority owner coming in with Lee, but maybe with their current Chinese owner, but maybe a minority owner sees that this is a great way to get in, get my foot in the door. Then when these Chinese owners have to leave the club, which I think is just a matter of when, not if, you already have a foot in the door and you can become the majority owner. So maybe that makes more sense. But to me, the sooner Milan changes ownership group, the better. I mean, every time they need to raise funds for their board, it can't be such an adventure to try to figure out when the money will be here. We need owners from Milan that actually we know for a fact have the money to make the club great again. If that has to happen through the Elliott Fund taking over and then finding another owner, so be it. But I think the sooner that happens, the better. As far as the sporting side of things, the sooner Milan returns to the Champions League, the better. I mean, I'm not sure we can say there's a huge connection between not being in the Europa League and making the Champions League. Let's just look at last season. Roma was in the Champions League, made a deep run. They finished ahead of Inter, who wasn't in the Champions League. Inter needed to get into the final minutes of the last match of the season to surpass Lazio. That wasn't the Europa League. So it's not that we can say that it's a given, you're out of the Europa League, you have a better chance. But with a limited squad, that would certainly help. So I know it's not the best of time for Milan fans, but I actually think the best thing is to take the bandage off. If things have to get worse before they get better, so be it. But the status quo just can't continue for Milan.
All right, staying on Milan, wouldn't it make sense for Milan to fire Gattuso and hire Sarri if he doesn't end up at Chelsea?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people suggest this. Gattuso, I thought, did way better than I expected as the manager of Milan. I actually didn't think he was going to last 2-3 months. I thought it was going to be a disaster. I thought he did okay. Sarri, on the other hand, had been close to joining Milan when he was at Empoli. They decided to go with Mihailovic instead. I think in retrospect, they probably regret that. And look, you know, Berlusconi would have had reservations to hire Sarri because of his political leaning. He's a pretty leftist type of guy. And because of the way he walks around with a tracksuit, on the pitch, not really the Milan look. But now with a new ownership, maybe they look at it differently. I always felt Sarri at Chelsea is an odd fit. It could still happen. It's not out of the question. But when I look at Sarri, you know, you got to ask yourself, would he want to coach another Serie A team? Does he have such a strong bond to Napoli that he won't do it? So it's an interesting situation. I think Gattuso deserves a chance, but if you can get a manager like Sarri, I would consider that as well. So that's the way I see this one.
All right, next one. This is interesting. Do you think Serie A will become a top six league like England, with Atalanta or Fiorentina regularly challenging for a spot in Europe?
It's a good question, and let's look at it. This season, we had Juve, Napoli, and Roma. I think those are still going to be really good teams moving forward next season. I actually think Napoli is going to have a drop-off just because of how good their season was in Serie A, but let's see if Ancelotti proves me wrong. Then, of course, we have Inter, who I think now has really helped by the fact they're back in the Champions League. I think that'll help them retain some players, maybe attract better ones. Let's see if Lazio can hold up. I mean, they've lost a lot of players. They've done very well in the transfer market, but they might be taking a step back in the short term. Atalanta's an interesting case because they've sold so many players in recent years, and they've shown a great track record of replacing them. So I'm not sure with Lazio and Atalanta if we can always consider teams that are going to be kind of competing a lot. You know, for Europa League, sure. For Champions League, that's a little bit different. And then, of course, though, we have Milan, who definitely has the brand recognition and has a lot of things going for them that they could be there. So we could maybe get to six teams consistently competing for the top spots, but I think we'll at least have at least four or five really good ones moving forward, which for Serie A compared to years past, I can assure you, is already a big step forward.
All right, how about this? With the Premier League introducing a winter break, what can we expect from it based on Serie A's experience with it?
One thing you can expect for sure is a lot of transfer rumors based on Instagram. What happens when Serie A breaks and a lot of the Serie A players go on vacation? Sometimes they go on vacation with players of other teams. They start liking posts, and a lot of transfer rumors are created that way. So I have a prediction. Indicaela is going to be very busy during the Premier League winter break. And, you know, for some players, it's also a great opportunity to rest up. We do see some teams being energized in the second half of the season. This is one of Allegri's trademarks at Juve. And even before he was at Juve, his teams always peaked in the second half of the season after the winter break. So let's see if some managers try to follow that blueprint as well. But there are some other players who, instead of resting, maybe get a little bit out of shape during the winter break. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see how it's going to apply to the Premier League.
All right, David, this is a very important question. Do you play FIFA, and what do you think of the questionable valuation of Italian players?
I do play FIFA. I'm not very good. I wouldn't even have the courage that our friends at Italian Football TV had of playing Matteo Bonetti. That would get ugly. Although maybe next season that my hometown team, Padova, is in it, maybe I'll let him use Padova and I can use Germany or Spain so people can see how poor my skills are. But I do play it. I really like the career mode. I think people shouldn't be surprised that I really enjoy the transfer aspect. I think I've done a career with pretty much every Serie A team just to see how I would handle the transfer market. Yeah, I've definitely noticed there's a little bit of a bias against some Serie A players, some really low ratings. But the one thing that I've noticed by playing the career mode, there's a lot of exciting young players in Serie A that if you do the little training sessions there, you bring up the rating. It would be nice that Serie A gets the respect someday where the players are just good off the bat. I've also read that next year, EA Sport actually has the right to call it Serie A instead of Calcio A. It was always interesting to look at people on Twitter refer to Serie A as Calcio A, and you could tell those are people that knew it mainly for FIFA. But I will miss it because it almost felt like a shout out to our podcast every time they said that name.
it doesn't hurt. It certainly doesn't. I should change my gamer tag to the Calcio Land podcast. All
there
right.
There you go.
David, last Twitter question. Let's move away from football. What album would you recommend to someone looking to get into rock and roll?
So I had the, because we didn't have the guests and I wanted to make sure the podcast was, a decent length size, I'm going to take a mulligan on this question. I was asked this about a month ago and there was a lot of albums that I regretted not mentioning. So I'm old. I grew up on rock and roll. When I was growing up, that was by far the most important musical genre. Now, definitely hip hop has become the new rock and roll, but there are still some good bands out there. But, if you're interested in learning more about the genre, I'm going to start with some more recent albums. And what I mean by recent albums are in my lifetime, so the past 30, 35 years, so bear with me. I think a great place to start would be Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction. I don't think you'd consider that a heavy metal album. I think that's more of a hard rock album. I think that's a great way to get started. Another one, a little bit more modern, but not that modern, is Nirvana's Nevermind. I think that album is really good for novice to rock and roll because under all the distorted guitars that you hear that, under the druggy image that Kurt Cobain had, there really are some amazing pop melodies on Nevermind. There's this great documentary on HBO on Dr. Dre and his career in music. And there's a scene where you watch him rocking out to Nirvana, which is really, really awesome. So I think someone who isn't that familiar with rock and roll, Nevermind would be a great place to start. Another album I recommend is a little bit more on the pop side, but definitely has a lot of rock attitude to it, is Oasis' debut album, Definitely Maybe. To me, it's kind of Appetite for Destruction and Definitely Maybe are debut albums that almost sound like greatest hits records because all the songs are so famous. If you want more on the alternative side, so see where a lot of the grunge bands from the 90s got their sound and a really big influence on rock and roll, I'd say the Pixies have an album called Doolittle, which is really excellent. A lot of people would say Surfer Rosa for the Pixies. That's a great pick as well. And I would say Jane's Addiction's Nothing Shocking is a great record as well. A lot of people know Ritual de l'Habitual for Jane's Addiction, but I think Nothing Shocking is more of a classic rock album. And then, from kind of like the hair metal rock of the 80s, I would say Motley Crue's Dr. Feelgood, really great album. The production on it is incredible. There's a lot of songs you would know. If you want to go a little bit more old school, I think some albums you can't miss are Van Halen's debut album. It's very short, but so many classics. That's really the Guitar Hero thing really went with that. I would say Eddie Van Halen's the most important guitar player since Jimi Hendrix, so you should definitely check out Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix. And the last two old school rock albums I would recommend, you have to have something from the Rolling Stones, which to me are the best rock band ever. The Beatles are more pop. I really like Beggar's Banquet, That's a great record if you want to get into them, and you'd have to mention Led Zeppelin, any of their first four albums, but I would pick the fourth one. So that's the podcast for today. We're going to have two more episodes later in the week. Please keep sending in questions with the CultureLand hashtag. I really appreciate all your guys' support with the reviews. We've got quite a few since last week, so please keep leaving the reviews. That's a great help for the podcast. Also, please keep tweeting about it. If you like what we do, tell your friends. We rely on you to grow, and we really appreciate it.